May it please the court, Robert Lichty on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Carruthers, number 14652. From the briefing, I think that the court appreciates that the issue in this case is the consequence of the fact that the claims were intertwined. Now, in a Wage Act claim, you're almost always going to have intertwined claims because you're going to have a breach of contract claim, and then out of that comes the Wage Act claim. It's somewhat similar to what was in Hartman, which is even a little bit further removed. But in Hartman, this court said that in order for the plaintiff to prevail, they had to have defeated the counterclaims. And so therefore, they were intertwined. And they said it was necessary to, in order to prevail, you had to prevail on everything. And that tends to be what happens when you're plaintiff. Now, on the defense side, you can whittle away at claims. And you can have certain claims dismissed. I mean, just not even in a Wage Act claim context, but in any other type of tort context, breach of contract context, you know, breach of contract and warranty, maybe the warranty claim gets dismissed. That's what we have in this case. So the fact that the claims were interrelated does not mean that with proper billing records, a trial court could not apportion the time that was necessary for the Wage Act claim and the time that was necessary for the breach of contract claim.
Okay, how is a court supposed to do that? I mean, here the situation is, if the plaintiff loses, let me reverse that. The plaintiff must win contract claim, or he cannot win the Wage Act claim.
Right.
All right, so doesn't that say they're fully intertwined? There may be other reasons, other legal reasons, why the plaintiff can't win the Wage Act claim, but it is still fully dependent upon success on the breach of contract claim.
And I pointed that out in the briefs, that the claims are not symmetrical. In other words, in order for a plaintiff to win on the Wage Act claim, plaintiff must win on the breach of contract claim. It doesn't apply to defendant. And again, don't forget, we've got another defendant and another set of claims here. The defendant Turn Networks and the claim against Turn Networks, that was all put all in the same billing, ultimate billing total.
So all the allegations are the same.
I mean, No.
There were allegations about Turn because it took over the assets and that sort of thing. But
allegations against Turn were separate. It was a promissory estoppel type claim where Mr. Carruthers said, well, after I was terminated and I was now and I was doing work that benefited Turn was benefited and I should have gotten some compensation for that. Entirely different claim because it's outside of the breach of contract. There was no contract between him and Turin, so he could not claim breach of contract.
Okay. But as to Turin then, your client had to prevail on the promissory estoppel claim
exactly.
To prevail on the wage claim.
Exactly, which was all part of that lump sum, $140,000. It wasn't divided out at all. So now, assume this. Assume that Mr. Carruthers had actually prevailed on the breach of contract claim. Let's just say he did. Carrier Access could nonetheless claim attorney's fees for the Wage Act claim, correct? Because it prevailed. In that case, does Mr. Carruthers have to pay all of Carrier Access's attorney's fees? Under defendant's theory of the case, yes, they do. Because the fees cannot be apportioned out. I submit that the case that this court should follow in its reasoning, I realize it's a different court, different set of statutory principles, but is the Fix case, the United States Supreme Court case. There, the court said that the defendant can get any fees it would not have incurred but for the frivolous claim. Or in this case, the defendant can get any fees that it would have incurred but for the Wage Act claim. In fact, that's the mandate of Carruthers 1. Carruthers 1 said, where we are remanding for determination of the fees in defending against the Wage Act claim. The court did not remand for determination of all the fees.
And doesn't prevent from considering whether the...
No. No, it doesn't. The bottom line here, though, is that a court could easily determine how many fees were necessary in order to get the dismissal of the Wage Act claim. Remember, the Wage Act claim was based upon the fact that the commissions were not due at the time of termination. They were due at a time later. And therefore, under the Act would not apply. And also that the amount of the commission at the time of termination was not a set number. Therefore, the Act would not apply. And it was upon those grounds that defendants were able to get the Wage Act claim dismissed prior to the end of trial. So there's a separate basis for dismissal. Now, to hold otherwise would mean that plaintiffs really would not want to bring Wage Act claims in the future because they're going to have to pay all the attorney's fees. So the change in the attorney's fees from shall be awarded to may be awarded. Remember, it used to be permissive. And then for two or three years, I'm now going back to the old argument, but for two or three years it was mandatory, and now it's permissive again. Well, if it's permissive, but you always get all of your fees, where is the discretion given to the trial court to determine how much fees go to the defense of the Wage Act versus how much fees go to the underlying breach of contract claim? Now, the judge in this case, Judge Bakke, actually did make a determination that there was insufficient proof of the fees. That's how she handled Mr. McFarland's claim for fees, the McFarland law firm. She said, I can't determine how many hours Mr. McFarland versus his paralegal versus his associate billed on this case because there were three different billing rates. And I know what the total dollar amount is, three different billing rates. I don't know what to divide into what in order to find out how many hours he spent versus his paralegal versus whatever. So she said that fails for lack of proof. I mean, this case would have been so easy for defendants to have proved up if they had submitted all their billing records, but they didn't. Probably because they didn't think they were going to win, is my best guess. I don't know if that's true or not.
That to collect, had to submit those up.
In this particular case, yes. In other cases, no. In other cases, maybe the total dollar amount, because in order for defendants to have prevailed the way they prevailed in that hypothetical case, they would have to prevail on everything. Why do you have to separate it out then? But in this case, we know that the Wage Act claim was dismissed before the end of trial. We know that $140,000 included fees in the defense of Turner Networks. So we know that there's at least two things that have to be separated out.
Well, assuming that, let's just assume for the sake of argument that the claims are so intertwined, the breach of contract claim with the Wage Act claim, that they're so intertwined that they can't be broken out. So we're looking at the total amount awarded.
Right.
Is it your position that defendants would have had to submit their bills, their specific bills, in order to justify and carry their burden of proving the reasonableness of their attorney's fees in that instance?
Yeah. Well, look, you raise an interesting point, to prove the reasonableness of the attorney's fees. Yeah, probably. And the reason why is, what if there's double billing? Well, the total doesn't show you that. What if there's billing that is mistakenly from another case that gets into this case? I've seen it happen. The total doesn't show that. What if the legal research on a really easy point was 60 hours? And the court says, that's a little high. I mean, you should be able to figure that out. But they had some associate on who didn't know anything about it, went off on the wrong trail, whatever. So yes, in order to show reasonableness, you do have to ultimately give at least the other side a chance to challenge the reasonableness. I mean, all I could do is say our fees were $50,000, their fees were $140,000. Doesn't seem all that reasonable to me. That's what we said at in front of the first judge in this case, Judge Sandstead.
Ask you another question then. Again, just for the sake of argument, let's assume that you're right, that those specific bills and specific itemization of time spent have to be submitted to the court to justify or support the reasonableness of their request for attorney's fees. If we assume that is correct, why would we have to address the intertwining of the claims?
You wouldn't. You could just say it fails for lack of proof, period. Now, I know that you're making case law for other cases, and I'm not saying that in every single case. Let's say we have a really simple case. It's in county court, and both attorneys' fees are in the neighborhood of $5,000. And the other attorney simply says $5,000, and the opposing attorney, whoever it is, doesn't question it, just says, yeah, okay, it's same as mine, looks reasonable to me. But so in that case, there could be an award of fees without having to do the individual, you know, the individual billing records. It's probably better to have the billing records, probably better to have that rule. But in a case like that, it's not challenged. But in a case like this, where it was challenged, where we submitted our fees of under 50,000, said, oh, it doesn't look reasonable to us, but we can't challenge it because the other side's not giving us the record upon which to challenge it. So there's a lack of proof. But the point you make, Judge Hawthorne, is correct. If you decide this case on lack of proof, you don't have to worry about the rest of it, because we know that there were fees that were used to defend Turin, and we know that there were fees for the breach of contract claim that went on after the dismissal of the Wage Act claim. I'd like to save the rest of my time if it's okay. If there's a question, I'll take a note.
May it please the court, Amy Hartman, Hartman Employment Law Practice, attorney ID number 32502. Your Honors, I would like to get back to the remand from Carruthers 1, from the court in Carruthers 1, and what the trial court in the case was instructed to do. And that was to determine the reasonable amount of carrier access's fees incurred in defending the Wage Act claims. And in doing so, the court in Carruthers 1 specifically said that they would not allow the trial court to reopen the record to allow for further evidence with regard to billing records or any other factual information. The court in Carruthers 1 did allow for additional oral argument, which did take place before Judge Bakke. Now, we don't know, there's nothing in the Carruthers 1 decision that tells us why it was that the court would not allow to reopen the record. But the court in Carruthers 1 knew the record and knew that the complete billing records had not been submitted to the trial court in deciding the initial issue.
Isn't the reason, Hartman, because you get one bite, you get to present evidence that you say, well, now I've evidence to prove.
Well, I don't know if that's the case, because clearly on a remand situation, the court could have instructed, the appellate court could have instructed the trial court to hold additional evidentiary hearing to allow for the submission of not new evidence. It would have been the billing records that existed at the time of the decision on the award of attorney's fees, but it didn't do that. And I would submit that maybe the appellate court was more prescient with respect to the Supreme Court's decision in the Fox case, in which the Supreme Court said that we don't want every argument on attorney's fees to be a second form of litigation. The Supreme Court in the Fox case said and recognized that litigation is messy and that we are not going to require our trial courts to sit as accountants with green eye shades and go through a voluminous determination of every aspect of billing records.
Ms. Hartman, my recollection is of the record is that when the court initially awarded the attorney fees, it did so in a very conclusory fashion. There was simply a number, that was it. It later came back sua sponte and dropped, lowered the number with no explanation. And in those circumstances, the previous panel really didn't know what to review. There were no findings by the court as to reasonableness and why that amount was reasonable. Couldn't that explain why the remand took place under the prior record?
Well, that explains exactly why the remand took place. It doesn't explain why the remanded specifically said we're not going to allow for additional evidence. But I will take issue with one thing. The trial court, Judge Sandsted, in his determination, which was based on extensive briefing and an extensive oral argument on the issue of the attorney's fees, he did find on the issue of intertwinedness. And he did find that the breach of contract claim and the Wage Act claim were intertwined. And as a result, he made a reduction in the overall fees. And the reduction was a 33% reduction. So he took the three claims, the unjust enrichment claim, the breach of contract and the Wage Act claim, and said the breach of contract and the Wage Act claim, maybe it was not this articulate, but the intent was there in the decision that he rendered, that those are intertwined. And so 67% of the fees is justified, and I'm going to discount for the 33%, which was the unjust enrichment claim. And the appellate court in Carruthers 1 did recognize also that that ruling had been made, that the trial court, Judge Sandsted, said that they were intertwined. So the issue of the intertwinedness has been addressed both by Judge Sandsted and by the appellate court in Carruthers 1. And then it was portioned out, and then it was remanded to Judge Bakke. And on the remand, let's focus on what the standard of review is by this court on the remand. It's abuse of discretion. This court needs to find that Judge Bakke's findings were patently unreasonable. And we are focusing on the intertwinedness, but we should focus more specifically on the efforts that Judge Bakke made, given the record that she had in front of her, to make reasonable findings of fact that should not be overturned by this court.
Let me tell you what's bothering me. There's a one-line entry in an affidavit that says the defendants incurred the following fees, which are reasonable, and that's it. That's, to be candid, that's the first time I've ever seen a one-line attorney fee billing for a piece of litigation, as opposed to preparation of a will or something like that. Don't you bear some obligation to show the court exactly how much time you spent, as opposed to just lumping it all together?
Well, the court in the Madison Capital case allows for the submission of affidavits in lieu of detailed billing records.
But the affidavits in that case describe the nature of the work performed.
They did. And at all times in this case, had there been a request by either the plaintiff's counsel or the court to supplement, we would have done that.
It's not their responsibility.
It's not their responsibility, but we submitted the record, and now two trial courts have, based on that record, determined the reasonableness of the fees. And
how do they do that, though? I mean, you've got, of course, the trial court, Judge Sandsted, sat through the trial, so he had some basis to see how much work the attorneys put in. Judge Bakke, on the other hand, has no basis, no independent basis, apart from the record. Maybe she read the whole record. I don't know what she did. But how is a trial court supposed to make findings that something is reasonable based upon a one-line entry saying we incurred this number of hours at this rate?
Well, let's go back to what Judge Bakke did do in her decision, because that's the decision that is on appeal today before you. And what I think that Judge Bakke did was eminently reasonable, even in light of the paucity, as you say it, of the supporting documentation. She was able to determine the number of hours that my law firm, the Hartman Law Firm, spent on the entire litigation, a 13-month litigation, 242 hours at a reasonable rate of $375 an hour. So she determined the lodestar quite readily, and then went on to look at the McFarland Law Firm and determined that because of the different rates, that she was going to not include any of the time from the McFarland Law Firm, where she could have easily done a blended rate or something like that, but she found that that was insufficient. So right there, the trial judge, Judge Bakke, reduced the amount of fees that were going to be awarded by over 35%. So clearly the lodestar, she determined the lodestar using the proper analysis.
How do you determine a lodestar? I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
How do you determine a lodestar based on a one-line entry? I mean, the lodestar is simply a statement that a number of hours spent times the reasonable hourly rate is the lodestar. But you've got to make the determination, don't you, first, that 242 hours was reasonable in this case, that the rate that you charged was reasonable in this case. She didn't do that, did she?
And she doesn't, well, she did do that in concluding that 242 hours, and she had specific findings on this, that 242 hours for a 13-month litigation, which comes out to less than 20 hours a month spent on litigation, was reasonable. So she did make that finding, and I don't think you actually need, until you get to trying to apportion out the fees for the different causes of action, I think that's completely sufficient. And Madison County and other decisions say that's sufficient. You've determined a reasonable number of hours expended in a 13-month proceeding that went all the way through trial.
But reason, this is much more than just how long the case was. I mean, don't you have to have some information as to the nature of the work performed before you can determine what's reasonable?
Well, I think that if you look at, if as the appellant had said, if you had hundreds of hours and this had raised any sort of red flags with her, then perhaps you would need to get further detailed in terms of the billing records. But when you have what is relatively not an eyebrow-raising amount of fees in the first place for a 13-month piece of litigation, then no, I don't think that you need additional detailed billing records on what every hour was spent. And if you look at the Maurer case, which we cite to in our brief, and we cited to both on the trial court below and to the appellate court in Carruthers 1 and here, in the Maurer court, even with detailed billing records before Judge Krieger, she had to go to a percent reduction. She said, I'm looking at the billing records and I see entries for depositions and trial preparation, and even with all of those billing records before her, she ultimately went to a 20% reduction for the claims that were not tangibly related to the same sort of causal set of facts.
But how could the court possibly do that without looking at the billing records? It's just a gut reaction. It's not a reasoned reaction, it's a gut reaction.
Well, I don't think it's a gut reaction at all. I think that the court and also the attorneys who are submitting the records are submitting them with the statement that based on sort of the complexity of the case, and then you get into the Dupré factors, which she articulated and went through each and every factor as part of her analysis and as part of her determination of the reasonableness of the fees. So what Judge Bakke did, which is completely appropriate and not an abuse of discretion, which is the standard that's before the court today, is she went through and determined, okay, I've got the basic number of hours and I've got a reasonable billing rate, and now I'm going to do, as the court instructed, apply the Dupré factors with regard to the degree of complexity of the case, how important the decision was that was reached, and all the other factors. And she went through those in a 3.5-page single-space decision and reacted to each and every one of the Dubray factors.
That analysis, after you calculate the load, so it requires calculation of a reasonable number of hours and a reasonable rate. And I guess what it sounds like we're all hung up on here is the reasonable number of hours, perhaps, without any, I mean, it's just a feeling that, oh, this is a long, complex case. Without the billing records, it's just a feeling. I mean, we can't tell. What about Mr. Lichty's point about how there are separate claims against Turin that have a separate factual basis? No way the court can determine how much time your law firm spent on that claim and those claims versus the claims against Carrier. And of course, we remanded only for fees against Carrier, mm-hmm. not Turin.
Right. And if you recall, again, what Judge Bakke did, and which was similar to what Judge Sandstead did, was not only did she eliminate all of the Evans and McFarland fees, so that brought it down to 35%, but then she went on, after calculating the Lodestar, and reduced the amount by another 33%. So we went from $140,000 in fees that we were claiming to the ultimate award that she awarded, which was $60,000, which again, under the abuse of discretion standard, is reasonable. If the Court of Appeals in Carruthers 1 had believed, and I guess we're sort of in a hypothetical, had truly believed that there was no way to award fees based on the record that was before the trial court, then by remanding the case and not allowing the record to be reopened, it was sending the trial court on a fool's errand. And I don't believe that that is what the court was doing in Carruthers 1. I think that the mandate in Carruthers 1 was to go back and, based on the record, calculate and come back to us with a reasonable finding of fact that we can review on the abuse of discretion standard to determine the reasonableness of the fees. The court in Carruthers 1 knew that the trial court was not going to have the billing records. So if the court had already predetermined for some reason that without billing records, no award of fees would be justified, then why remand it?
Is that asserted in Carruthers 1? Was there an assertion that based upon the record that was available then, which was the one-line billing, did anybody assert that as a matter of law that couldn't be sufficient?
Yes, the appellant asserted that in addition to arguing on the frivolousness standard, they also asserted that there was no reasonable finding of the fees, and that the court had abused its discretion in awarding fees, and has argued throughout that without the billing records, and argued to this court that without any billing records, there should be an award of zero fees. And I see that my time is up.
I see that the panel has the same concerns that I do in terms of the reasonableness. When I saw that their billing records were, that their total billing was $142,000, and I compared it to mine of under $50,000, I said, well, right off the bat, I don't think it's reasonable. And I pointed that out in our response brief before Judge Sandstead to the fees, and I said, you know, they haven't even submitted their billing records. I pointed it out. I didn't ask for them because I don't want to prove their case. But I pointed it out, and they had a chance to submit the billing records with the reply brief. They had a chance to submit the billing records in the hearing that we had in front of Judge Sandstead, and it wasn't done. I submit that the claim fails for lack of proof. Now, if I were a plaintiff claiming that summary judgment shouldn't have been granted, and can I have a second chance so I can submit more evidence, you wouldn't give me that chance. It's the same type of thing. I mean, this is a claim. They become like the plaintiff when they're trying to prove up their attorney's fees. They didn't prove the attorney's fees. Simple as that. And there's no way in the world that this court can determine if Judge Bakke there's no way in the world this court can determine how many hours were spent defending the claims against Turin, because there's no hours there. Nor is there any way that this court can determine how many hours were spent working on just the breach of contract claim. I mean, look at the summary judgment brief. 18 pages long, two paragraphs devoted to the Wage Act claim. The rest of it's all devoted to this other claim, which we know was independent because it continued on after the Wage Act claim had been dismissed. And I want to raise this point again, because under defendant's theory of recovery, even if Mr. Carruthers had prevailed on the underlying breach of contract claim that went to the jury, let's say the jury found in his favor, defendant could argue that they get all of their fees for defending against that claim also because it went on the Wage Act claim. Because they're intertwined, can't be separated, we get all or nothing. And I submit that would be particularly bad law. But that would have to apply in reverse if this court goes along with defendant's theory of recovery of the fees. I see my time is just about up, and if there's no more questions, I ask that the court vacate the trial court's judgment and remand for finding that no fee should be entered.
Counsel, for your arguments this morning, we appreciate the time you've taken on this case. The case will stand submitted with a written opinion in due course.